Welcome to a podcast brought to you by the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists. Our academy is a national organization committed to excellence in orthopedic manual physical therapy practice, education, and research. And we're here to explore a wide range of topics with you through interviews with content experts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the AOMPT Research Podcast. My name is Danu Jayaseelan, and today I'm pleased to be joined by Dr. April Brown to discuss her case report titled Osteosarcoma in a Man Referred for Lumbar Radiculopathy, which was published in the April 2020 issue of JOSPT. Dr. April Brown is a clinical instructor of physical therapy at LSU Health Shreveport's Program in Physical Therapy. She earned her DPT and Master of Science in Clinical Investigation from Washington University and St. Louis School of Medicine in 2013. She is a board-certified orthopedic clinical specialist, certified in orthopedic manual therapy, and completing her fellowship through Optum Manual Therapy currently. Dr. Brown's research interests include physical therapy management and treatment for patients with chronic pain conditions, functional dry needling and effects on movement, and blood flow restriction training for patients with strength deficits. Dr. Brown, thank you for joining us today.
Great. Yeah, thank you for having me.
So I wanted to start by discussing your patient case. It's obviously complex, and putting it into such a brief manuscript is difficult to do. Do you mind just telling the listeners about your patient and how they presented and what you did with this person?
Sure. So this gentleman came to our faculty clinic, and he was in his 40s, and he had the chief complaint of worsening right hip and right groin pain over the previous 2 months. So he stated that initially his pain started with a bursitis type of pain on the lateral side. And he was also a healthcare provider, so he was familiar with some of these musculoskeletal dysfunctions and issues. And so he was trying to take care of it himself. And he thought that it was getting better. Then he had this issue that in the previous month, he had his foot stuck underneath his motorcycle. And he did this real forceful hip flexion with some rotation motion on that side just to get his foot unstuck. And during that time afterwards was when he really noticed this worsening of his hip pain, like significantly worse. And also off and on was having some back pain. And for the back pain, he went to a chiropractor 2 times within those 2 months and had it adjusted, and his back pain felt better. But the hip pain never got better and was worsening. He even described that at one point he had to walk with a walker because the pain had gotten so bad. So once that occurred, he went to an orthopedic physician. And so the orthopedic physician immediately referred him for a lumbar MRI and then also referred him to PT. So when we saw him and the MRI, the radiologist report was an L1-2 disc bulge. And then oddly enough, the left side had more issues than the right side. So more foraminal narrowing and more degenerative changes were seen on the left side compared to the right. So it didn't quite add up to what he was reporting subjectively as far as this groin pain, potentially maybe something going on with a disc bulge, but definitely had some more issues on the left side. So we took him through our exam. We did, you know, a standing test, had him go through all the range of motion for the lumbar spine, and he had no reproduction of symptoms, especially like with repeated flexion, there was no issues. And his range of motion was probably even greater than what would be considered normal for the lumbar spine for flexion. He had a lot of lumbar flexion and stiff hamstrings. He had increased pain in the anterior region when he did lumbar extension, but again, no range of motion deficits in the spine, and no back pain with lumbar extension, but he just had this anterior groin pain when he went into lumbar extension. So we did our neuro screen with him. Sensation was within normal limits, both bilateral intact. His reflexes were normal, both sides. But on the right side, he was weak and painful. And of course, it's difficult to discern if he was weak because he was in pain. But it was all of his myotomes on the right side were painful and were decreased strength compared to the left. So that was just odd if we're thinking about like a specific nerve root issue potentially. Everything on that side was just, it was uncomfortable and painful. So when we had him do our special test for the hip, we did Fader and Faber, and all of those, like, the range of motion was fine. It was these end range motions that he had pain with, especially into internal rotation. And then with standing and single leg stance, he could stand on his right leg and keep his balance for 25 seconds, but he had pain in that right hip. When he went to go stand on his left leg for single leg stance, he couldn't hold it for more than 10 seconds because he had to hold his right hip into flexion. And it was too painful to do that. So at that point, it seemed more clear that it was a hip issue, not necessarily coming from the low back. Additionally, we did our neurodynamic screen as well, sensitizing maneuvers for neurodynamics with our internal rotation and adduction of the hip with straight leg raise, and similar things with the slump test, and nothing reproduced his hip pain except for actively doing hip flexion or a resisted hip flexion. So based off of this mechanism of injury, we were thinking that maybe he either had like a hip flexor strain or there was some sort of labral involvement potentially. At the second visit, he came into us with 8 out of 10 pain. The evaluation really flared him up and wasn't easily calmed down. So Ashley Gonzalez, who was our orthopedic resident at the time, I asked her to come in and take a look at him with me just to see if there was anything that she could add or additional thoughts she may have for this patient. And she did some more specialized neurodynamics. She had just gone to a continuing education course on lower extremity neurodynamics and did some additional things just to rule out any neural involvement potentially. And nothing reproduced his hip pain like he had been experiencing it. So we decided to maybe treat it as a hip labrum, maybe hip flexor strain, and do some, you know, calm it down before we can build it back up. And so it was real active range of motion through pain-free or tolerable ranges, heel slides, you know, bent knee fallouts, those types of things. We did some gentle accessory mobilizations for the hip just to calm it down. And then he came back for that third visit and he had to use a walker. Pain was so severe, like he couldn't go to work the previous day. And at that point, we knew that there was something just was not right. So we recommended that he follow up with the orthopedic and really get an imaging of his hip to see if what could be causing these kinds of symptoms or see if there was something additional going on. And that's when the x-ray at the orthopedic's office revealed that he had this lesion in the proximal femur, and he was immediately referred to a specialist in Dallas, and they treated him from that point on.
Thinking about like someone coming in with what seems to be a clinical pattern associated with a hip with a mechanism, a known mechanism, and you're recreating symptoms with a certain position, it all sounds very musculoskeletal in that way. So the fact that he progressively got worse is one thing that obviously would make you think about imaging. But I would also see, and I've seen this a lot, is that clinicians do their examination and they make their patient worse or their symptoms feel worse. And now we know so much about pain, and we can think of that as being maybe I've created more sensitization on this person. Maybe this person's hip is just becoming a little bit more flared up and they would continue to treat that. Or if they come in with a walker, maybe this person's becoming hypervigilant. You know, that's like a buzzword now, is I have to try to talk about pain neuroscience education. So was there like a gut feeling, or what specifically made you go for imaging versus keeping this person with you a little bit longer?
So this gentleman was very active. He was very healthy. We had him do a FAB-Q at initial evaluation, and there were no concerns based off of what he was saying or any fear avoidance behaviors or any fear of movement, really. Like he was ready to get back to his normal life. He wanted to get back to work. He was a highly motivated individual. So he wasn't somebody that I was concerned with might be maybe fearful of movement or anything like that. It just didn't feel right from what we were doing, especially, I mean, it was the activity we were doing was so conservative and so light that to have him present with these kinds of increase in symptoms, it just didn't seem like that was, you know, it didn't fit his personality, and it didn't fit the progression of what we were trying to do.
I think it's really important then as a clinician that you listen to those soft skills and you take all that objective data, whatever you have, and you couple that up with, you know, this just doesn't seem right. And sometimes it's hard to make that determination. But it's also hard, I think, to make some of these determinations based on imaging or the lack of imaging. And so this patient came in and he received a lumbar MRI that showed a disc herniation at L1, which theoretically can go into the groin, you know, mm-hmm. So that makes sense. And he's having pain with extension that's recreating his groin pain. So I think it's important. Sometimes we get caught up with, you know, there's so many asymptomatic people showing pathology on imaging. Well, in some cases, it actually might be pathologic. There's sometimes a disconnect. In this case, obviously, if our listeners go and look at this picture, there's something going on in his hip for sure. There's no debate about that. And it's coupled up with what you saw. In terms of him coming in and having gradually or actually rapidly worsening hip symptoms, did you retest and find that things were a little different? Was he too sensitive to do? I'm just trying to think of, you know, if we have students or newer residents or clinicians having similar cases, what do we ask them to do to check if this person needs additional testing?
That's a great question. And based off his presentation, I didn't feel comfortable doing, you know, retesting, giving him any sort of manual resistance in the case of like hip flexion, or he was so irritable that a lot of times some of our special tests and the things that we do are designed to provoke symptoms. And he was, again, so irritable that I wasn't trying to provoke his symptoms, and I would prefer to have been able to relieve his symptoms. And that was going to be my okay to proceed. Like, if we can get him to calm down and the pain to decrease, then I know that we can continue on the path that we're on. But to retest him within a short amount of time, and the fact that he became so irritable in that short amount of time, I didn't see the reason for me to proceed with provoking those symptoms even more.
I mean, when you think about people presenting to the clinic, we have to gauge our evaluation treatment largely on symptom irritability and how much can we get good information from this test. In this case, I don't even know what doing a Faber again would have really gotten you, you know. So making that decision in the moment to not flare this person up by doing a test that doesn't necessarily direct my treatment too much, I think that's a really good idea. You know, I'm still a practicing clinician, but primarily I'm in academics now. And so I always try to figure out how do we rapidly identify these clinical patterns of people with maybe more red flag conditions. And osteosarcomas are not common in middle-aged individuals, you know, they're more common under 25 typically. Mm-hmm. And in the paper, it said that he didn't really present with any constitutional signs or symptoms. If you had to do this again and saw someone similar, what objective or subjective data from his presentation would have made you think red flag more than musculoskeletal?
Again, another good question. Everything. He was a healthy individual, no, you know, had yearly physical exams, had just been to a physical exam within the previous year. Everything was fine. He denied night pain, especially like the typical things you would think of as malignant issues. He denied all of those things. And I honestly don't know what could have come out of his subjective or any further objective measures that would have made me think, oh my gosh, this is a red flag, besides, you know, seeing him for that week and that just significant increase in his hip pain. I don't know. And what I find interesting also is that, you know, he reported this stuff, the symptoms started 2 months prior to coming to physical therapy, and that he had seen a chiropractor and also, you know, a physician for his issues, and that they didn't catch anything either. So I don't know. I really don't know if there was anything more that I would have been like, oh, let's get you in for an imaging like on eval day.
Right. And again, going back to our discussion on imaging, I think it would have been inappropriate to send him for imaging day one if you didn't have data suggesting that he was progressively getting worse or not getting better. And he also did go to two other clinicians who saw this person and didn't catch anything else to begin with. So, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I think case reports like this are so important, is that like as much as we kind of talk about here's what a red flag will look like once you get to clinic, they don't always present like textbooks. And very often the ones that aren't textbooks are the ones that we have to deal with.
Right.
I think it's great that your case report was published. But to that point, I also know that publication can be so challenging for a busy clinician. And as you were going through this patient case, you were a clinician. And so for those individuals that are in the clinic and they're treating and they're seeing these patients that are not the textbook case for red flags and they're off the beaten path, what advice do you have for those clinicians that would like to disseminate that information and get that information published? Because I know as a clinician, when I was starting to publish, it's very difficult.
You know, do your due diligence with a patient. And if you find something really interesting, just take the time to write up a brief summary. It doesn't have to take you hours upon hours, but if you start with a brief summary and then, you know, continue to go back to it and refine it before submitting it, be familiar with the publication guidelines and all of this, you know, as somebody new to publication process, having somebody around you that may know that process and can guide you to like author guidelines for whatever journal that you want it to submit to. But it is important to get the clinician's perspective on especially unique cases to help that decision-making process. It's great for the profession to encourage these clinicians to write up cases that can help others in their decision-making.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. I think it's hard to get started into the process, but disseminating things like this, it's really important to think through. You know, if I have a patient that comes in with low back pain and hip pain, the chances of a 48-year-old individual having osteosarcoma are pretty low. But if this person's progressively getting worse without me doing much, I have to start thinking red flag. Oh, yeah, I saw Dr. Brown's paper. This could be something else, maybe more in the hip. And so let's go ahead and inform my decision making with some of this evidence. I think that's huge. And so I would love to see more of these types of papers coming out. And I appreciate you putting this forward, because I know even if it's 250 words with JSPT, that probably took a lot of effort and time to put this together.
It could definitely be a process. It took over a year with revisions just for this short manuscript. And again, allowing yourself to have that time and to just take your time and being thoughtful in the write-up and going with the reviewer's suggestions and not being in a rush to get it done. It's nice to have a finished project, but knowing that you can take your time with something like that, and that when you do take your time and it does eventually get out there, that it can provide a great value to your fellow clinicians, that makes it the best thing for everyone.
What's your clinical practice like now with COVID?
We have our guidelines set for our patient care. So everyone gets their temperature taken when they arrive, and we're limiting the number of people in the clinic. But overall, you know, we went from when all of this started in the spring to post-op patients only. And now we've gradually been bringing our regular patients that may be non-emergent back into the clinic. But we're just following our guidelines, our state guidelines, phase two guidelines, and just limiting the number of people that we're seeing. Masks are worn by everyone, and then temperature checks as well.
Yeah, so you started your fellowship in the fall. You have a number of years left to complete it. Do you have any advice for individuals thinking about going into residency or fellowship at this time, now that patient care has been modified based on COVID? Do you have any recommendations for people thinking about post-professional education at this time?
Yes. So I think now more than ever, it might be more important to pursue some sort of specialization. And the only thing I can think of right now is that I feel I feel for these students right now that are going through, that have to do clinical rotations, either this huge clinical rotation they've been wanting to go on, they're now not accepting students, so they're not getting this experience from maybe a really well-known hospital or a really well-known clinic because they don't want students in their building right now. So I feel for these students, they're not getting the experience that they would have without COVID going on right now. And so for anybody that's even thinking about specialization, now might be an even more important time to do so, because you may not have gotten the experience that you may have without COVID. And I mean, physical therapy is such a broad profession that if you really want to hone your skills and be good at clinical reasoning and continuing this lifelong process of learning, I can't speak enough to how valuable residency programs and fellowship programs are. But and that from personal experience, I didn't do a residency program. I'm now in a fellowship, and I just, with our residency program here at LSU, I just can't believe the value that is added when you do this specialized training. And again, with the experiences, the clinical experiences that might be closed down for students right now, if you want to be specialized, now more than ever might be a good time to pursue that.
Yeah, that's an interesting take on it. I would agree. I mean, for a lot of our students, we're losing clinical sites and clinical placements based on rules and requirements of different jurisdictions. So having additional training on the back end after graduating, obviously that isn't a bad thing. And I'm a big proponent of post-professional education in general. But in the meantime, as we're trying to transition our face-to-face to maybe more hybrid and virtual, I think the clinical reasoning component is something we can kind of describe. And I think it's really helpful to have papers like yours where we can explicitly show this is a patient that came in with a referral for low back pain, but this is really what's going on at the hip, and having a concrete example rather than maybe more abstract discussions. I think that's really helpful. So this is something I'll put into my teaching for sure. So I appreciate you putting this forward, because I know, again, like you talked about, it's easy to see the patients in clinic. It's hard to describe them and write them up.
Yes.
So again, I wanted to thank you for your time. We'll be putting up some show notes with some contact information, if that's okay, for our listeners to get in touch with you if they had any more questions about your patient or any of your research interests.
Yeah, sure.
Thanks for talking to us today, Dr. Brown. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
This has been a production of the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists. You can learn more about the Academy by visiting our website at aaompt.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by searching for our acronym, AAOMPT. The views and opinions expressed on the AOMPT podcast are those of the interviewers and interviewees and do not represent the official position of AOMPT. The information presented should not be used as personal health care or clinical practice advice. If you need to find an expert orthopedic physical therapist near you, then check out the Find a Fellow feature under the Public Resources tab at www.aaompt.org, which you can find in the show notes.